Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There's a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. We restructured Entree Architect Academy to be more powerful, more accessible, and more affordable. Did you know that for only $27 per month, you can now gain unlimited access to more than $2,000 worth of resources, courses, and video archives, all built to help you build a better business, be a better leader, and live a happier life as a small firm architect? And we're adding more every month. Learn more about Entree Architect Academy at entrearchitect.com. You're listening to Entree Architect Podcast, and this is episode 173. Welcome back to the Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and this is the podcast dedicated to a successful life as a small firm architect. Whether you have plans to someday start your own firm, whether you're in the process of launching a startup, or you might be an experienced small firm architect just trying to make a difference, this podcast is for you. My goal is to inspire you to build a better business so that you may pursue your purpose with passion and live the life of your dreams. I am really loving the episodes from this new series, The Entrepreneur Architect, where I'm sitting down with real small firm architects talking about real issues, issues that we are all dealing with, and hearing real stories of working and living as a small firm architect. And I hope that you're enjoying them too. I hope that they're motivating you and inspiring you, and I hope that you're gaining valuable ideas and information that you can borrow and take them back to your firm and apply them. And I want to share your story too. We all have a story. And I know you may be thinking right now, you may not think that your story is that interesting, but it is. The most powerful shows that we have here are the ones where, yes, I'm dealing with that too, and I've gone through that struggle, or my goals are just like her goals. Sometimes confirmation is validation, and you never know how your story might help change the life of another person, another small firm architect struggling to get to where they want to go. That you've been through that process, and you can share your story and inspire somebody and let them know that it's going to be okay. So come share your story here at Entree Architect Podcast. Email us at podcast@entrearchitect.com and request to be on the show. This week, I'm finally talking with a longtime friend of Entree Architect. He's been sharing his knowledge with the Entree Architect community for years. I appreciate his support and his selfless quest to share what he knows with others through teaching, through writing, through actively participating in the ongoing discussion out there on the internet about living and working as a small firm architect. This week at Entree Architect Podcast, I'm speaking with my friend, Lee Callisti. Entrepreneur Architect. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by our platform sponsors, FreshBooks, NCARB, BQE Software, and RCAT. And I'm going to share more about these great companies and organizations later in the show, but as we get started here, just take a quick note to schedule some time this week to go visit each one of them and let them know that their support is appreciated by us, the Entree Architect community. Lee Kalisti, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thanks, Mark. It's good to be here. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. Lee is based in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, not far from Pittsburgh. He's a licensed architect and the founder of Lee Kalisti Architecture and Design. He was one of the original founders of AIA Pittsburgh Chapter's Young Architects Forum and was that co-chair for 7 years. He's also served as a regional liaison, representing Pennsylvania as part of the AIA National Young Architects Forum. He serves on the City of Greensburg's Historic and Architectural Review Board, and he serves his community as trustee for the Greensburg Alliance Church. He's active in social media as an ardent promoter of the profession and a regular writer for the Global Architects Architect blog series, Architalks. You can search Architalks, hashtag Architalks, all over social media, and you'll see dozens of blog posts written by architects, all on the same subject each month. Really, really interesting program that Bob Borson over at Life of an Architect started and is growing its global blog series right now. It's really, really good. You can read all of Lee's blog posts over at thinkarchitect.wordpress.com. So, Lee, I just gave everybody a little bit of a background on who you are. I'd love for you to start off here with your origin story. Talk about where you discovered architecture, what inspired you to become an architect, and then just give us that story, your journey from that point to where you find yourself today.
Thanks, Mark. I've written about this before, and I have talked about it often because I'm one of those unusual people that wanted to be an architect from the time I was very young, which apparently is pretty rare these days. Early on in my grade school, I discovered drawing more than just doodling like some kids, but had a passion for comic books and would replicate the things that I saw there and develop those skills and art skills in those early days. And a couple of years into that, came across some things that were more architectural. And the art teacher I had at junior high school was a great inspiration to me. Architecture became fascinating, and I began to look at books in the library. These were pre-computer days. And all throughout those early days, this one inspirational teacher promoted creativity and said it was okay to be the creative type of person, and it was an encouragement. He didn't teach me anything about architecture, but just be able to think creatively and to develop these skills. And it wasn't long before I was designing houses and building models. They may look silly these days, but as a young kid, it was quite fascinating. My mother bought me a drafting table when I was a young kid, and I would sit there for hours and do something. Throughout high school, I just pursued art classes. I did have a drafting class, but really the art classes are what made things good for me. And a couple of library books and a couple of contacts with architecture in that fashion was enough for me that I was bitten. But I had no idea what the world of architecture was about, being in a small town and not having access to information like young people have today. But I just knew I wanted to be an architect. It was not something I considered. Apart from that, I didn't worry about job prospects or salary or any of those types of things. It was a single-mindedness, maybe naive, but I applied for school, went to another school for a year prior, took care of some basic classes, and plunged into the world of architecture. Had to actually start taking design classes at night. I went to Kent State University. The only way I could get into the program was by taking night classes. They had a program for interior designers, and they offered the design studios for night classes. Well, the serendipity behind that was I got connected with an architect who was a professor, adjunct professor, teaching the class at night. Most brilliant professor that I had in my 5 years of college, and was, again, another inspirational teacher that really, really inspired me because he was doing work on the side as an architect. He was doing work for his firm, and he would bring in examples of the things that he was doing to show us models he was building and drawings he was making and paintings. And I thought, wow, here's a person that's doing this not just as a job, but as a life. And after I went through his classes and moved up through the other years of school, I would actually go to his class in the evening to see if I could catch him after class to see if he would talk about my work. And this patient, patient man would stay late all throughout my rest of my schooling. Many years later, I caught up with him last year, went to lunch with him in Cleveland to thank him profusely for being so patient and inspirational to me. And, you know, 20 some years have gone by since that time, and he remembered me, and it was a great inspiration. But so you can be that inspirational person in the life of someone behind you as a mentor. You may not even realize it, but these two teachers made a huge difference to me. But walking into school that first time and being exposed through books and magazines and seeing other people's work just made my taste for architecture insatiable. It was such an amazing, exciting thing to see what is going on in the world. So I knew I had chosen the right thing. Went through school, was pretty obsessed. I'm told I was top of my class. I didn't know that was a thing or a goal, but revealed it to me at the end. Graduated, and there was a recession at the time, 1991, and I went back to work for an architect that I'd spent summers with. And it was a very good learning process to learn kind of the nuts and bolts of working in practice and what's involved in that. But eventually I needed to spread my wings, and I went to work in downtown Pittsburgh for 8 years, and very, very exciting experience from 1995 to 2003. To be in a big city, to do and be exposed to a lot of different things. And it was those days that really prepared me to launch my own firm. A lot of things happened. It's a long story in and of itself of how I got to my own firm, but my son was born in 2002, and that was a big driver, but not the only driver to launching my own firm in 2003. I had started teaching in 2002 at Carnegie Mellon University as an adjunct that had kind of fulfilled this vision that I had had in my mind of being an architect and teacher, which was the same thing that this professor I mentioned in first year was. He was this architect and teacher, and I thought, well, I want to be just like he is, but I still want to do exciting work. Well, that went pretty well. But the early days of starting a practice were rocky, like most people. I didn't have any clients. I didn't have any work. I just knew that I needed to do something else, or I was going to not be able to breathe. I wasn't going to get anywhere, and I was never happy in just having a job and just doing buildings. Architecture always had to be more than that to me. Not everybody can take those risks. Not everybody can have those luxuries. But for me, architecture was always such a big thing that just being in a job and doing things that are part of an architecture firm were not enough. Well, everything that led up to that point prepared me, but couldn't replace just the hard work that it takes to start a firm. But I've always been very frugal, so I borrowed money from our own personal savings. And I promised my wife I would pay it off by the end of the year. And that happened in 2003. Work started to slowly come in. through various methods, and the year wasn't a good year financially, but I did pay off the loan. I paid myself back, and I never borrowed money from a bank. In fact, in 14 and a half years, I've never borrowed money from a bank. Just a personal goal, principle that just was important to me. Well, you know, you look back, and in February, I've been in business for 14 years on my own, so not quite 14 and a half years, but, and it's hard to see all the details because you're kind of looking back over mountaintops, and they all tend to blur into each other, all the individuals up and down. At the end of 2014, when that semester ended, I realized I couldn't teach and practice anymore. It was a hard decision because it was such a part of my identity. And a lot of my readers from my blog understand me as a professor and an architect, and they have heard and read me talk about practices and traits that a young architect need to have, and drawing and sketching and those kinds of things, talking about school and getting through school. But the good news was is the practice was busy and I needed to focus on it exclusively. And I didn't say goodbye forever. I just said, I can't teach next semester. Well, next semester turned into five. And I don't know when that'll be, but I think if I wanted to go back there, and I asked nicely, I think I left that door open for the future. It's really, really important to have a connection with students and teach them what this profession's about in a real way. Having practiced for so long, I think I can keep a balance between the realities of practice and, again, deal with what architecture education ought to be, even though it's changing constantly. But so now the firm is busy, almost too busy. I considered hiring my first employee last year, went through the process. It didn't pan out. I'm not done with that yet. But I actually took some of the advice of some of our fellow bloggers and friends that I've made through this group, and started the wheels moving towards expanding to that first employee. Even though it didn't happen, at least it caused me to start to think a little differently and how that would be and how it would work, and it'll happen at some point when the time is right.
So that's a big goal. That first employee is a big one. I remember my first employee. It's really difficult to sort of get to that point and take the leap to do that. There's a lot of commitment. There's a lot of fear behind that. There's a lot of change that has to happen when that happens. It took me two or three employees making mistakes and picking the wrong person or picking the wrong level before I finally got to that right person. And so I could definitely understand, taking your time and going through that process. What is another goal that you have set and you have achieved? And how did you describe a little bit about what you went through to achieve that goal?
I've thought of this a lot, and I probably need to set more goals along the way, but I'm going to go back in time to when I was, we'll call it an intern. We don't use that term anymore, but when I was working for an architect, a graduate architect, I had started a combined Bachelor of Architecture master's program in school, and I didn't finish graduate school, but I had started my master's, and that's another conversation. But getting a license was something that was very, very important to me, and I know that that opens up a great conversation in our world as architects, and I like to participate in that conversation. But for me, regardless of what anybody else's opinion is, for me that was very important. The program that is formerly called IDP was not a digital program, but a paper record keeping program at the time. And I was working in an office that was sensitive to that. But for me, getting the license as soon as possible was what I have referred to students over the years as winning the Super Bowl or winning the World Series or the Stanley Cup as a professional sports people. I've given the silly advice or the naive advice that no one starts a professional sport or no one starts any kind of sport like that expecting to do anything less than to win the championship. Otherwise, you wouldn't participate in that
right.
in that sport. And you could use that same analogy in any world, whether you're an actor and whatever the case may be. But so I went through the program as quickly as I could, and I did extra things to get the requirements of that program complete. I had to do supplemental things and writings and interviews and all kinds of things to fulfill those requirements. It was something that I got through, and I was pretty upset that I didn't get through it in the first 3 years because that was the minimum time it would take. Well, go back to 1995, and this is an era when the ARE was not digital. It was still in the paper form in those days. I think it ended the following year or the year after that. And so the ARE was only offered once a year, and I was determined I was going to pass it all first time. One is I just have that personality flaw of being obsessive, but I was going to pass it first time. The person I had worked for had done that, and he didn't even have a degree. He went through the old way. But to me, not passing the first time was, I don't know, it may not make sense to anybody else. So I had started earlier the year before with all the materials that one uses to study for the ARE. There's so many more after that. Evan has a great book on that, but plunged into that, and I just took it the way I normally do. Every single day I spent time studying without fail, 7 days a week at lunchtime. It was just a discipline that I think goes back to my athletic days as a runner in high school, that you just had to do things every day nonstop, because if you stop doing it once, you'll stop at 2 days, you'll stop at 3 days. And it was just a trait that I picked up from a high school coach. Studied for the thing and went into the test, and it was probably the most intense 4 days of my life ever. College was intense, granted. But to combine all that into a four-day pill and swallow that was something I had never experienced. Met up with some buddies from school who was taken at the same time. Got through the exam, and they make you wait 3 or 4 months to know the results. And so that was in June of 1995. That seems a lifetime ago. And in September, I get a letter in the mail from, I don't know if it's from the NCARB or maybe it was state of Pennsylvania, but a letter in the mail, and it just gave the scores. It was known that if you get a score over 70, I believe, you know, you pass that section, and all the sections are listed and all the scores are in the 80s and 90s. But there was nothing on there that said, congratulations, you passed. So I'm reading this letter with my wife, Amy, and I'm showing her, I'm like, did I pass? I wanted to dance around, but it didn't say, it just said, here's your scores. And I thought, somebody, please help me. So after looking at it for 30 seconds, I was dancing around. I felt like those who win the Super Bowl or win the World Series or name your championship, name your goal. But it wasn't for a day or two more until I got a letter from, the registration board, the state of Pennsylvania, and congratulations, you pass, and so on and so forth. But I tell this story that I've told to my students over and over again that summarizes that intensity for me. So imagine sitting at a drafting table in a convention center in a room for 12 hours, and you can't leave except to use the restroom. You have to bring your lunch, you have to bring your dinner, you have to bring everything. You can't leave because of obvious reasons. And you're working on paper to do your design exam, and it's intense. And I had a schedule for every section. I had to be done by this time, and so on and so forth. And I hit all those schedules, and I had an hour left, 11 hours in, I had an hour left, and I had enough time to check my work. And I could sense I was getting a nosebleed. I never get nosebleeds. So I knew that it was just from the intensity. And my wife had packed tissues and we cared for it. And it wasn't a problem. that's all I'll say about that. But it kind of summarized the intensity of that moment of how intense it is to take that exam. So my heart goes out to those who are taking the ARE right now. And I just cheer for them and say, get it done. Do it.
Yeah, and real blood, sweat, and tears.
It is. And I want them to know that there's a whole family of architects out there that are rooting for them and that we're all here to support them and whatever they need to do to get there. But obviously it's been 20 some years since that took place and it's kind of hard to believe. But for me, that was a personal goal. My family didn't quite understand all that was involved. They just knew that, that's a big thing. And then there was no fireworks. There was no lightning. There was no confetti. You just kind of went to work the next day. Eventually the firm I was at in Pittsburgh, acknowledged it and there was all the things that was in place to address that issue. But there have been other milestones along the way, but that was just something that is seared in my memory that was very important to me.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. I think you just brought back a lot of architects who've been through that struggle. I was in the year after that, and I did take it through the computer. And so you were the last one on paper. I just avoided that by 1 year. That has its own problems because, I mean, one of the issues with having it, being able to take it whenever you want, and be able to take it in different pieces is that the procrastination sets in and you'd end up not taking it when you should. And it takes years and years to pass it. So there's pros and cons to those things, but I agree. It is a struggle. And it's also interesting. You had mentioned earlier about the influence that we have on younger people and not necessarily students of architecture, but even prior to that, you were influenced by somebody early on to discover architecture. And then again, in school, there was somebody there, cheerleading you on and supporting you and making sure that you stay enthusiastic about it and inspired. It's so important for us to do that. The opportunity we have online to connect with people is great, but to have that one-on-one connection, that mentorship with younger people to encourage them to keep going and to get licensed is so important. So thanks for sharing that.
Let's take a quick break here to say thank you to our platform sponsors here at Entree Architect, RCAT, FreshBooks, NCARB, and BQE Software. You already know all about RCAT and their free BIM objects and their CAD details and their specifications and product information, all free, ready for you to use. Well, today I want to share something new from RCAT. It's called Charette. Charette is a tool for sharing and collaborating with your colleagues and clients online in real time. You can upload photos and files, share specs and product information directly from the RCAT database as well as from other sources on the internet. I've been playing with Charette in beta for a while now, and it's really cool, and now it's available to you. I encourage you to go check it out. Visit RCAT online and click the Charette icon right there on the homepage. And like everything offered at RCAT, Charette is a free tool for us small firm architects too. Learn more at entrearchitect.com/RCAT. 192 hours. You wish you had that much free time? That works out to about 2 business days every month. And when you're a small firm architect using FreshBooks cloud accounting software, that's the amount of administration time that you could save in 2017. That's time that you can spend doing the things you love, like being an architect. FreshBooks makes it simple to send invoices, post your expenses automatically, track your time for your whole team by project, and get organized with reports, communication, and notifications. Sign up for a free 30-day unrestricted trial and get ready for the simplest way to be more productive, organized, and most importantly, get paid faster. Visit entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks to access FreshBooks for free. And be sure to enter Entree Architect in the How Did You Hear About Us section.
Do you know someone in your firm who's always dreamed of getting licensed, but was unable to complete the experience requirements? Well, maybe that person's you. Now you can get back on track with NCARB's new AXP portfolio. With this option, seasoned professionals can complete the Architectural Experience Program, the AXP, formerly known as the IDP, by submitting an online portfolio. Along with meeting your state's education and examination requirements, the portfolio will help you and your employees get one step closer to becoming a licensed architect. Learn more about NCARB's AXP portfolio at entrearchitect.com/NCARB. One of the most often requested resources here at Entree Architect is project management software. How do we keep our projects and our people organized while we grow as entrepreneur architects? BQE Software, an AIA Advantage partner and the makers of ArchiOffice, will show us how. ArchiOffice is the only office and project management software designed specifically for architects. It will help us manage people and projects and allow us to focus on designing great architecture. Whether you're working remotely or on site, ArchiOffice allows you to monitor the status of your projects and tasks and send out invoices in an accurate and timely manner. Entree Architect podcast listeners can get a fully functional 15-day trial of ArchiOffice today at entrearchitect.com/BQE. RCAT, FreshBooks, NCARB, and BQE Software, please visit our platform sponsors today and thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. How about a struggle that you've dealt with, something that has you've had to overcome in your career? Tell us a story about that.
You know, I'm not exactly sure what may come to mind. I guess the first thing that flashed in my mind was I've been in practice many years, and I had a situation with a project where I thought legal action may take place. And the end of the story is it didn't, and it all worked out. So I'll say the end of the story immediately.
I've been there, so I know what that feels like.
Nothing happened, and everybody lived happily ever after. But I was probably had been in business 7 or 8 years, and was working on a project, and some technical things started to go wrong. I will say that, again, this is a whole nother conversation, but I wasn't formally involved in construction administration. So this is one more of those stories that cement those of us who promote that as a service as being necessity.
I agree.
And some things took place, and I don't want to get into the dirt or whatever, but some things took place that happened, and there was two specific changes that were that don't appear on my documents. But they were decisions that were made, the owner made with the contractor. And but it took a while to point to those as being the likely culprit for why there was water infiltration and some other things going on. And the owner was kind of like a drowning person, just trying to grab at anything that would save them from this situation. And I had learned to be cordial and work through the situation. And I probably spent more time than I should have trying to do what I was thinking was being nice and being helpful and those kinds of things. But I had been in constant contact with my insurance company. Get your insurance if you don't have it, by the way. I was in touch with my insurance company, who was an advisor along the way of what to do and what not to do, and probably should have been more abrupt along the way. But it wouldn't go away. I was never blamed. But there was this intimating that maybe there was a design flaw or whatever. And I kept going back to the point, look, this is what's going on. Well, I'd spent hours through what we would do is the documentation process and how do I cover myself. And, you know, we always look back and can see that I could have done. That detail could have been more clear, this and that, you know, and you kill yourself on those issues. And though, yes, I could have made that more explicit, I could have done that. But how do you know in pages and pages and pages of documents and specs that those few details would be the one that needed more attention? You can never know that.
Right.
Well, finally, my insurance company said, look, the advisor, legal advisor for the insurance company said, look, you need to handle this. You need to end it. And here's what you're going to do. You're going to write this letter and here's how it's going to go. And so we formed that letter. We went back and forth. We crafted it very carefully. It was as brief as it could be. Sent the letter. And lo and behold, it ended. And it ended abruptly. Well, you fast forward through a couple of years, and I've run into this client. We still remain friends. And the client admitted to my face that I, as the architect, was right. I did nothing wrong. The problem was on the other end, and they should have hired me to oversee construction in the typical construction administration phase that we as architects know. Again, that's another topic of discussion of what that really means to your listeners. But those of us as architects know what that means and what that service looks like. But so now we run into each other often, and he's still dealing with that issue, but he knows and admits that it had nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
But I lost some sleep over it. I think I grew an inch taller. And
how important was it to you, looking back in that situation, how important was it to you to have that guardrail of liability insurance, knowing that that was there to support you if necessary? How important was that with you sort of psychologically and emotionally to get through that situation?
Well, I knew that we had an LOL, limitation of liability clause. And again, you can explain that at some point when it's important to do that, Mark. But fortunately, I had the LOL clause. And I knew that, so I had a safety net there, and I knew that it was never going to be more than this.
Right.
So it gave me peace of mind at that. So I knew that it was never going to bleed more than a certain amount. But for me, my name has always been important to me, and it's the only thing I own. And I didn't want to go through that. I'm a peacekeeper kind of person, and any kind of unresolved relationship situation eats at me.
Yeah.
I can't sleep until I know that situation is resolved. And I am a perfectionist in some sort that I kick myself if I do something wrong. And how could you not have made that better? How could you not have seen that? Whatever. So I had to get over that I had done anything wrong. I thought that any other architect could have looked at what I had detailed in my specs and said, well, okay, we could have done this, but face value, what you had was clear and what you had was fine. And the details of the situation were not a fault of yours. But yeah, the insurance, you can't practice without insurance. Don't even try. The amount of money that you pay isn't small, but in the big picture, it's tiny compared to the damage that you could get yourself into. In fact, when I opened my practice, it was the first thing I did was I went to the broker that my previous firm had, and we got it all set up. And in fact, I just renewed again. No architect should practice without it. It's just unfortunate, the world we live in, but it's a necessity.
Yeah. And you never know where it's going to come from. Like you said,
no.
You're making thousands of decisions, maybe tens of thousands of decisions,
right,
for every project. You never know where it's going to come from. And typically it's all good and it's all clean. And if something comes up, you can resolve it, but you never know. And so you really, to practice without liability insurance and to work without contracts, you know, there are architects that are working with a handshake. To have that contract with a liability, limited liability clause, it helps you. Even if you didn't do anything wrong, it helps you emotionally knowing that those things are there. To be able to think clearly and to proceed with what you need to proceed with. So thanks for sharing that story. What's one thing that makes you or your firm unique? What makes you different than other architects?
I'm nuts.
Well, we're all nuts. So.
You know, I like to think that balance has always been the key to my success. I didn't, when I graduated top of my class, I wasn't necessarily the best designer there in terms of purely artistic, aesthetic design. I have two really good friends that I stay in touch with these many years later that were brilliant, very gifted people. And I thought I was really good at it, and I still think I'm really good at it. But I was able to balance that with all my other classes. So as an architect, I consider myself an artist. I just wrote a blog post about that, that I make art. I still lean heavily towards the art side as an architect, and I sketch and I draw, and my readers in my blog know that. But you can't just be an artist as an architect, for as much as I promote that, that I really believe, at least my expectations of myself as an architect, is balance. There's so many things that we have to do or expected of us as architects, and I just expect myself to be good or facile at a lot of different things. And a lot of those things aren't necessarily fun or interesting or things that we aspire to doing, but you have to get them right. And there's really no reason not to get them right, whether we have a consultant or a friend. Again, we have this tremendous network of family as fellow architects that we're just a text or a tweet away from one another. Hey, can you help me with this? And you can help me with that. But our clients expect us to be able to do all those things. So balance has really been the secret for me, is being able to do a lot of different things and getting them all. Certainly have strengths, certainly have weaknesses, but we need to be able to do all those things. I have high expectations of what architects ought to be, or I have a high expectation of what I as an architect need to be. And being creative or being skillful from a design standpoint is only one of them. There's so many more, and some of those other skills have been really successful business generators for me. So
let's get into some quick questions. I call this the lightning round. Other blogs or other podcasts call it the lightning round. I call it quick questions. At what age did you decide to become an architect?
9 or 10.
Okay, same as me. By the way, you and I actually, from your origin story and actually your personality you just described, you and I are very, very similar people. Just as a side note.
I'm honored.
Yeah. Well, what's your target market? What type of work do you do?
Right now, I have a really good balance between what seems to be two different things. We have a lot of adaptive reuse projects for urban buildings, especially in the city of Greensburg. With a little modern twist, taking buildings from the late 1800s, early 1900s, and repurposing them into something new, which I could speak for hours.
What type of buildings are they originally?
Banks. The typical, let's call Main Street, two, three, four story buildings that have these really beautiful character facades, brick, terracotta, stone. But we always inject something of today, something modern, something contemporary. And I have a lot of modern contemporary residential projects, new construction, major renovations, additions. So there's seemingly two different things. To me, there's a connection, but that's where a bulk of the work is. I do have some retail tenant fit out type of work, but adaptive reuse and modern residential seems to be these two major building types.
I've never done adaptive reuse, but it's something that's always interested me. I have my mom is a history fanatic. We grew up learning American history and it's always something that's interested me. I'd love to be able to do some of that work. We just have never done it. But it sounds like a fun sort of taking an old building that was once used for something else and reinventing a use for it. I think we're going to be doing that with a lot of shopping malls in the coming years. These gigantic buildings and these big boxes that are all over our nation that are empty these days.
No, it's a great conversation that we need to be having as architects. It's very, very important.
Yeah. Stipulated sum, hourly or percentage-based fee or other?
It seems that most of my commercial work is lump sum, stipulated sum. Again, a lot of reasons for that. Residentially, believe it or not, I've been doing hourly for residentially for a long time, and I've offered other methods. It seems that we get through schematic design with hourly for a lot of reasons, a lot of known reasons, because we can't predict things. Usually I give a not to exceed, but generally I've built trust after the schematic design phase and we move into the latter phases, design development, construction documents, construction administration, I often offer something else, but they generally feel trusted with that arrangement, that we continue with that. A lot can be said about that, but generally that's what works yeah. for me.
Other than architecture, what makes you happy?
Obviously my family. I have a beautiful wife, a fantastic son, deep faith in Jesus. Those types of things are very important. But personally, making things, photography, graphics, the hobbies that got me started are still things I do today, and they're so related to architecture that I'm always doing something that seems to be analogous to the practice, but it's relaxing to me.
What are some of your hobbies?
Again, photography is very, very relaxing to me, and a lot of architects get into that, but it seems that with, you know, graphic skills that we have as architects, that I either am always monkeying with something on my own, or somebody else asks a favor, a church or somebody else like that, and you get to use skills as an architect for something else. But apart from all that, I love to travel. I love to see new things. We like to go to new restaurants. We like to try new foods. Those kinds of things I like to do with my family. Repeating things are okay, but new things, we love to see and explore.
Yeah, going on adventures. We do that with my family. We do birthday adventures and we do Christmas adventures. So instead of a birthday party, since my kids have been born, we've never done the whole kids' birthday parties. We have a family birthday party, bring all the family, and then we do a birthday adventure and we go somewhere and we experience something.
That's a great idea.
It's a lot of fun. And we do it with Christmas too. My mom and dad come to New York, and we find a new place to go, and we go and spend a day doing a Christmas adventure every year. It's a lot of fun, and the best memories of our lives. You know, we're creating the best memories with those opportunities.
So important, very important.
This will lead right into this next question. What's the best advice you ever received?
I said this to a couple times to people today, and I don't know the exact origins of it, and maybe someone can tell me, but so it was either told to me by a colleague or I read it somewhere. But from a business standpoint, I learned, and if I'm repeating someone very famous, forgive me, I learned that if I listen to what is really being said by the client, what is really their need, what's keeping them up at night, what's giving them unrest, and it's generally not a design or aesthetic issue. It's usually something else, but it's different for everybody. I try really hard at the very beginning to ask driving questions, and I listen to what's their real driving need. And I found if I can answer that question first and provide the backup, and it's usually technical or some type of non-graphic response, but if I can answer that question and that concern is put at ease, and they're like, whew, then the aesthetic or the design or the visual or whatever you want to call it, spatial aspects that we enjoy as architects are often given over with very little boundaries. So if I've met their needs and if I demonstrate that I've listened to what their real problem is, and it's usually not something they state, it's usually something you have to pull out of them and restate back to them, or it takes a little bit of research sometimes, but you go back to them and you say, look, I think this is really what the key issue is on this design problem. And it's different for every single person, every single board, every single client. But when I've been able to satisfy that up front, when I present to them schematic design options in the first visual sketches or imagery is given to them, whatever that may be, however it manifests itself, I get very little pushback. Usually, oh, we love it. We love one of those schemes, as opposed to them saying, well, we want this style where it must look like this or must look like that. If I listen to them, then they let me take the project in a direction that not about me, but where I think it could go or can go and is ultimately in their best interest. It works almost, it just works every time. It's a skill that takes nurturing.
Yeah, it's something that you need to develop as an architect. It's not something that we typically learn. We don't learn that in architecture school. That's from sitting, talking to people for years and years and years and figuring that out or listening to this podcast and taking your advice and learning that that's something we need to do, because it's not something they say. They don't typically describe that in words. It's something that we need to to discover through a conversation and other ways.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you have one personal habit or a daily routine that contributes to your success?
The first few things I thought about were not so much habits. They were just traits, you know, diligence, optimism, and idealism. They were more traits, but I'm going to make the plug. If you talk about habit, is sketching. And I don't mean drawing beautiful pictures, but I mean the real architectural sketch that's ugly and dirty and scribbly and whatever. It's terribly relaxing to me. I carry my goofy sketchbook everywhere I go, but I find that if I put that, pencil on the paper, if you're an iPad user with a stylus, go ahead. But if I do those kinds of things, one, it gets my thoughts out. And two, it keeps those skills fresh. Maybe I'm a dinosaur, but it is just a really, really important skill. I've written about it ad nauseum, and I'm going to continue to write about it. It's not about making the pictures that we all show and brag about. It's just a communication device. And the funny thing is I've learned to do it upside down, because when I'm with a client at a coffee shop, for instance, right. I've learned to draw upside down. And they are amazed. And I'm not saying that I'm great. I'm just saying that it's a skill. It's a skill that one needs to do, because they can't do it. And if you can show them a graphic that represents them, and you're willing to put them forward, put them more important than you by doing it upside down, the reaction is really amazing.
Yeah, that is our magic as architects, to be able to sketch live in front of a client, because they can't. I mean, most people can't do what we do.
No,
and to practice it, to do it on a daily basis or a regular routine, intentionally sitting down and sketching, will get you better at it. And it also develops a piece of our brain that doesn't develop anywhere else unless we're doing that.
That's what's really important about it. It isn't the end result. It's the getting there. It's the thought process behind it.
Yeah. How about a recommended app or an internet resource?
I'm probably the least tech savvy, so I don't have all these great apps to talk about. Here's a really silly one. I use this app. It's called Pitch Gauge. And it's an app that I think builders use to figure out what's the pitch of a roof so they can use do takeoffs for shingles or whatever. I've used it to measure approximately measuring the pitch of parking lots and sidewalks and whatever, as I look at accessibility issues or any kind of technical issues dealing with architecture, and I need to know. I don't use it as an end goal, but it's just a quick app. I can whip my phone out, I can lay it down on the sidewalk and see if the pitch of a parking lot or sidewalk is remotely close to meeting accessibility guidelines.
Interesting. So it's using the iPhone's level
ability?
Interesting. Correct. I'll have to look that up. I think that's a great recommendation. Thank you for that. I'm going to download that myself.
Pitch Gauge.
Yeah, you could probably do it for roof pitches too, right?
Well, it's meant for roof pitch, because it has a camera. It has a camera section to it.
Yeah.
And it merely just takes the level section of your phone and tells you at what number in 12 units is the slope.
Very cool. How about a recommended book? If you're an old school guy, I'm sure you still read.
I have a lot of books that came to mind. Right now I'm reading a book. I'm in the middle of it, so I don't know, called All In by Mark Batterson. I do read mostly things that are related to my faith and things that are related to the Christian walk. So they're not necessarily architectural business related. But what I really like about this book is it talks a lot about commitment. Now, the commitment is more faith-based, but it really talks about commitment. And I think I can draw parallels from those levels of commitment. The other books that came to me, another one was really fun that my wife introduced me to, is called The Road Back to You. And it's written by Ian Morgan Crone and Suzanne Stabile. And it's it's kind of, again, somewhat, people might think it's religious, but it talks about personality types and self-discovery. And what's really helpful, I think, as an architect, is understand how we're made, what's our personality type, why we do the way we do. It's the whole reason I write my blog. It's the whole reason I wrote Think Architect. But I realized through an ancient device called the Enneagram where I am on that personality type. It's not a limiting thing, but it's just helpful to know, hey, this is the kind of person I am. This is how I was made.
What number are you?
I'm clearly a four.
Yeah, I haven't. He's been all over the podcast world in the last couple of weeks. So I just was introduced to him. That book's on my list, and I have to learn what my number is.
Oh yeah, it's I thought I was a one, a perfectionist, and there's a connection there, but I'm a four with a five wing, but clearly a four. A lot of different names for it, but the artistic individualist, no doubt.
Yeah, the book's called The Road Back to You, right?
That is correct.
Road Back to You. Yeah, we'll have that listed on the show notes for anybody who's interested, and those numbers will make more sense if you read the book. I'll link some of the podcasts that he's been on too. He's been interviewed a bunch of times recently. He was on the Entree Leadership podcast, Dave Ramsey's podcast recently. It was very interesting. And I never knew anything about Enneagrams? Is that how do you say it?
Yeah, it's an ancient device, and there's a lot of different ways of looking at it. Secular, spiritual, religious, Christian, a lot of ways of looking at it, but it's just a device and a tool. My wife is teaching a Sunday school class in a youth group to it, and so she had me read this book, and I was interested in it. And she's a different number than me, and it's also a very useful tool to understand other people.
Right.
A very way of developing empathy and compassion to other people is by understanding a little bit about maybe where they're at and how they're made.
We'll definitely have that linked up. Let's get into that final question that I ask everybody on the podcast. What's one thing that an entrepreneur architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
You know, I'd have to say adapt. Depending on where you're coming from and how you start your business, you could come from a lot of different scenarios. I've watched people come from very large firms and try to develop sole practitioner firms, and they struggle. I came from a small firm background, so it wasn't that big of a leap, but you have to adapt to dealing with different kinds of people. You have to adapt to dealing with a different kind of work setting, a different type of work day, a different type of building type perhaps, but you're constantly adapting as architects, and that doesn't come easy for me. But I know I have to keep adapting to different situations, learn new things, and adjust to how the practice or how the world of architecture is going. Otherwise, you're just going to be lost in the back. The whole social media was an adapt process for me. I didn't give it a lot of credence up front, and now I'm, you know, drowning in it in terms of from a professional standpoint.
Yeah.
I promote it. I use it. I think it's a great tool to promote our profession as architecture. Obviously, it can be used for good. It can be used for bad. But to promote this profession, what a cool thing! And it's given me opportunity to meet so many really good friends. But yes, adapt. Otherwise, you adapt or die.
Yeah, I want to also put in a plug for social media and the architect community on social media. I also have met so many, including you, Lee. Have been friends through the internet all these years. There is a very, very tight group of architects on Twitter and Facebook and elsewhere that have bonded, many of us through the Architalks blog series, on the Entree Architect community, on the private Facebook group. Is really a really great community there. But anywhere that you there's social media, there's another tight group on LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. If you're an architect listening to this and you're not on social media, and I know there's other risks of getting on social media where it will overwhelm you, but if you stay focused on building relationships with some architects on social media, they will bear fruit. They will make friendships. They will be your advisors. They will be your supporters. They will encourage you on a daily basis, especially as a sole practitioner. That's your community. That's your water cooler. So, if you're not online, you can start if you want to go on to entrearchitect.com/group. We'll take you to the Facebook group. It's a really, really active, dedicated group of people over there that every day, you know, if you post a question, you'll get 30 or 40, 50 comments on a thread in that group. And Twitter too. If you post on Twitter, and follow a group, if you don't know who to follow, follow Lee or myself. I'm at Entree Architect everywhere, so if you want to find me. But if you just, you know, tag me in Twitter, I'll introduce you to everybody I know. So definitely a great, great group of people there. Lee, how about a parting piece of guidance for other entrepreneur architects? And then we'll wrap it up with you can telling us how we can connect with you, maybe some social media. And if somebody wants to just reach out and say thanks, how do we do that?
I would say that social media is really a key thing, and promote the profession first, and then the individual results will come in. But if we promote our profession in whatever manner you do that, I just think that's the first thing we need to do, and the your own personal practice will eventually benefit from it. But join the conversation. You can reach me at thinkarchitect.wordpress.com. I love to have lively conversations about architecture, ones that are civil and ones that are worth getting into, lively. I don't mind disagreement. I think we all learn from each other. The tag Lee Calisti is usually is my handle for Twitter and Instagram and all those types of things that can be easily found. I can't hide. LeeCalisti.com is my website. You can see my work. I love being an architect. I just love being an architect, and I love being part of this community. I have some really highly, highly respected friends in this community.
Yeah. Lee, thank you very much for spending some time with me here and sharing your story here at Entree Architect Podcast.
Thanks. It was a lot of fun.
Hey, if you liked what we shared here today, complete show notes with links to everything that Lee and I spoke about and a direct link to download this episode so you can have a very own copy on your hard drive. It's all there, right there at entrearchitect.com/episode173. And if you want to be featured here as a guest on Entree Architect Podcast in the Entrepreneur Architect series, come hang out with me, tell your story, inspire others, connect with me anywhere on social media at Entree Architect. I'm on Instagram, on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're all over. Or send me an email, podcast@entrearchitect.com, and let us know that you want to share your story here at Entree Architect Podcast. And don't forget to visit right now we're wrapping things up here on the show, go visit entrearchitect.com and go check out what Entree Architect Academy is all about. It's our private online membership. It's built for you. It's a program built for you. 3 levels. You can join at any level that you want. You have resources, you have training, live webinar training, or the mastermind groups. You can go reserve a spot for a mastermind group. Visit the homepage today at entrearchitect.com. My name is Mark R. LePage, and I am an entrepreneur architect. And I encourage you to go build a better business so you can be a better architect. Love, learn, and share what you know. Thanks. I thank you. I thank you for listening, and I want you to have a great week.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns. What's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glenn Gary. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.